the number one ladies' detective agency. Written by Alexander McCall Smith and read by Adjua Ando.
Ma Ramotswe had a detective agency in Africa, at the foot of Khale Hill. These were its assets: a tiny white van, two desks, two chairs, a telephone, and an old typewriter. Then there was a teapot, in which Ma Ramotswe, the only lady private detective in Botswana, brewed red bush tea, and three mugs, one for herself, one for her secretary, and one for the client. What else does a detective agency really need? Detective agencies rely on human intuition and intelligence, both of which Ma Ramotswe had in abundance. No inventory would ever include those, of course. There was also the view, which again could appear on no inventory. How could any such list describe what one saw when one looked out from Ma Ramotswe's door? To the front, an acacia tree, the thorn tree which dots the wide edges of the Kalahari. In its branches, in the late afternoon, or in the cool of the early morning, one might see a go-away bird, or hear it, rather. And beyond the acacia, over the dusty road, the roofs of the town under a cover of trees and scrub bush. On the horizon, in a blue shimmer of heat, the hills. Everybody called her Ma Ramotswe, rather than Precious Ramotswe, a name which very few people employed. She was a good detective, and a good woman. A good woman in a good country, one might say. She loved her country, Botswana, which is a place of peace. And she loved Africa, for all its trials. "I am not ashamed to be called an African patriot," said Ma Ramotswe. "I love all the people whom God made, but I especially know how to love the people who live in this place. They are my people, my brothers and sisters. It is my duty to help them, to solve the mysteries in their lives. That is what I am called to do." In idle moments, she would sit under her acacia tree and contemplate some of the issues which, in everyday life, may so easily be pushed to one side. "Everything," thought Ma Ramotswe, "has been something before. Here I am, the only lady private detective in the whole of Botswana, sitting in front of my detective agency. But only a few years ago, there was no detective agency. And before there were even any buildings here, there were just the acacia trees and the riverbed in the distance and the Kalahari over there, so close. In those days, there was no Botswana even. Just the Botswana Land Protectorate. And before that again, there was Kama's country. And lions, with the dry wind in their manes. But look at it now. A detective agency, right here in Khabarone, with me, the fat lady detective, sitting outside and thinking these thoughts about how what is one thing today becomes quite another thing tomorrow." Ma Ramotswe set up the number one ladies' detective agency with the proceeds of the sale of her father's cattle. He had no other children, so every single beast, all 180 of them, went to her. They fetched a good price, as there had been heavy rains that year, and the grass had been lush. Had it been the year before, when most of that southern part of Africa had been racked by drought, it would have been a different matter. "I want you to have your own business," her father said to her on his deathbed. "You'll get a good price for the cattle now. Buy a business, a butchery maybe, a bottle store, whatever you like." She held her father's hand and looked into the eyes of the man she loved beyond all others. Her daddy. Her wise daddy, whose lungs had been filled with dust in those mines, and who had scrimped and saved to make life good for her. It was difficult to talk through her tears, but she managed to say,
"I'm going to set up a detective agency down in Haparone. It will be the best one in Botswana, the number one agency."
For a moment it seemed as if he was struggling to speak. But he died before he could say anything more. And Mara Motswe fell on his chest and wept for all the dignity, love and suffering that died with him. She had a sign painted in bright colours, which was then set up just off the Lobatse Road, on the edge of town, pointing to the small building she had purchased. "The number one ladies' detective agency, for all confidential matters and inquiries. Satisfaction guaranteed for all parties. Under personal management." There was an interview on Radio Botswana, in which she thought she was rather rudely pressed to reveal her qualifications, and a rather more satisfactory article in the Botswana News, which drew attention to the fact that she was the only lady private detective in the country. This article was placed prominently on a small board beside the front door of the agency. After a slow start, she was consulted about missing husbands, about the creditworthiness of potential business partners, and about suspected fraud by employees. In almost every case, she was able to come up with at least some information for the client. When she could not, she waived her fee, which meant that virtually nobody who consulted her was dissatisfied. The mere mention of the fact that she was a private detective would let loose a positive outpouring of information on all sorts of subjects. This happened with Happy Bapetsi, one of her earlier clients.
"I used to have a happy life," said Happy Bapetsi. "Then this thing happened."
Mara Motswe watched her client as she sipped her bush tea. Everything you wanted to know about a person was written in the face, she believed. It's not that she believed that the shape of the head was what counted. It was more a question of taking care to scrutinise the lines and the general look. And the eyes. The eyes allowed you to see right into a person, and that was why people with something to hide wore sunglasses indoors. They were the ones you had to watch very carefully. Now this Happy Bapetsi was intelligent. That was immediately apparent. She also had few worries. This was shown by the fact that there were no lines on her face, other than smile lines, of course. So, it was main trouble, thought Mara Motswe.
"Let me tell you a little about myself first," said Happy Bapetsi. "I come from Maun, right up on the Okavango. My mother had a small shop, and I lived with her in the house at the back. We had lots of chickens, and we were very happy. When I was a little baby, my daddy had gone off to work in Bulawayo, and he had never come back. Somebody had written to us, another Motswana living there, to say that he thought that my daddy was dead, but he wasn't sure. He had gone to see somebody at Mpilo Hospital one day, and as he was walking along the corridor, he saw them wheeling somebody dead out on a stretcher who looked remarkably like my daddy. But he couldn't be certain. We decided that he was probably dead, but my mother did not mind a great deal because she had never really liked him very much. And I couldn't even remember him, so it did not make much difference to me. I went to school in Man, run by Catholic missionaries. One of them discovered that I could do arithmetic rather well. I suppose it was very odd. I could see a group of figures and I would just remember it. Then I would find that I had added the figures in my head, even without thinking about it. And I went off to Habrone and learned how to be a bookkeeper. Again, it was very simple for me. I could look at a whole sheet of figures and understand it immediately. Then, the next day, I could remember every figure exactly and write them all down if I needed to. I got a job in the bank, and now I am the number one sub-accountant, and I don't think I can go any further because all the men are worried that I'll make them look stupid. I don't mind. I get very good pay, and I can finish all my work by 3 in the afternoon. I go shopping after that. I have a nice house with 4 rooms, and I am very happy. To have all that by the time you are 38 is good enough, I think.
Mara Motswe smiled. You're right. You've done well.
But then, said Happy Babetsi, this thing happened. My daddy arrived at the house.
Mara Motswe had not expected this. She had thought it would be a boyfriend problem. Fathers were a different matter altogether.
It was a Saturday afternoon when I heard this knocking. I got up, went to the door, and there was this man, about 60 or so, standing there with his head in his hands. He told me that he was my daddy, and that he had been living in Bulawayo for a long time, but was now back in Botswana. I had to sit down, or I think I would have fainted. He told me my mother's name, which was correct, and he said that he was sorry that he hadn't been in touch before. Then he asked if he could stay in one of the spare rooms, as he had nowhere else to go. I said that, of course he could. In a way, I was very excited to see my daddy, and I thought that it would be good to have him staying with me, particularly since my poor mother died. So I made a bed for him and cooked him a large meal of steak and potatoes, which he ate very quickly. Then he asked for more. That was about 3 months ago. Since then, he has been living in that room, and I have been doing all the work for him. I make his breakfast, cook him lunch, which I leave in the kitchen, and then make his supper at night. I buy him 1 bottle of beer a day, and have also bought him some new clothes and a pair of shoes. All he does is sit in his chair outside the front door and tell me what to do for him next.
Many men are like that, interrupted Mara Motswe. Happy Babetsi nodded.
This one is specially like that. He has not washed a single cooking pot since he arrived. I would not resent this, you know, except for one thing. I do not think that he is my real daddy. I think that he heard about our family from my real daddy before he died and is now just pretending. I think he is a man who has been looking for a retirement home and who is very pleased because he has found a good one.
Mara Motswe found herself staring in frank wonderment at Happy Babetsi. What astonished her was the effrontery, the sheer naked effrontery of men. How dare this person come and impose on this helpful, happy person? What a piece of chicanery, of fraud, what a piece of outright theft, in fact.
Can you help me? Asked Happy Babetsi. Can you find out whether this man is really my daddy? If he is, then I will be a dutiful daughter and put up with him. If he is not, then I should prefer for him to go somewhere else.
Mara Motswe did not hesitate. I'll find out. It may take me a day or two, but I'll find out. Of course, there were blood tests these days, but she doubted very much whether this person would agree to that. Nope. She would have to try something more subtle. Mara Motswe picked up the nurse's uniform from her friend Sister Hohwe. It was a bit tight, as Sister Hohwe, although generously proportioned, was slightly more slender than Mara Motswe. But once she was in it, she was a perfect picture of a staff sister at the Princess Marina Hospital. It was a good disguise, she thought. As she drove to Happy Babetsi's house in her tiny white van, she reflected on how the African tradition of support for relatives could could cripple people. She knew of one man, a sergeant of police, who was supporting an uncle, two aunts, and a second cousin. If you believed in the old Setswana morality, you couldn't turn a relative away, and there was a lot to be said for that. But it did mean that parasites had a very much easier time of it than they did elsewhere. They were the people who ruined the system, she thought. They're the ones who are giving the old ways a bad name. As she neared the house, she increased her speed. If the daddy was sitting outside the front door, he would have to see her arrive in a cloud of dust. The daddy was there, of course, enjoying the morning sun, and he sat up straight in his chair as he saw the tiny white van sweep up to the gate. Mara Motswe turned off the engine and ran out of the car up to the house. Dubelara, she greeted him rapidly. Are you happy Bapetsi's daddy? The daddy rose to his feet. Yes, he said proudly. I am the daddy. Mara Motswe panted, as if trying to get her breath back. I'm sorry to say that Happy was run over and is very sick at the hospital. Even now they are performing a big operation on her. The daddy let out a wail.
Hey, my daughter, my little baby Happy.
A good actor, thought Mara Motswe. Unless... No, she preferred to trust Happy Bapetsi's instinct.
Yes, she went on. It is very sad. She is very sick, very sick. And they need lots of blood to make up for all the blood she's lost. We don't have the right sort. We will have to get some from her family. And you are the only one she has. We must ask you for some blood.
The daddy sat down heavily.
I am an old man, he said.
That is why we are asking you, she said. Because she needs so much blood, they will have to take about half your blood. And that is very dangerous for you. In fact, you might die.
The daddy's mouth fell open.
Die?
Yes. But then, you are her father, and we know that you would do this thing for your daughter. Now could you come quickly, or it will be too late? Dr. Mohile is waiting, said Mara Motswe, reaching down and taking his wrist. I'll help you to the van.
The daddy rose to his feet and then tried to sit down again. Mara Motswe gave him a tug.
No, I don't want to, he said faintly. I won't. You see, I'm not really her daddy. There has been a mistake.
Mara Motswe let go of his wrist. Then, her arms folded, she addressed him directly.
So, you are not the daddy. I see. Then what are you doing sitting in that chair and eating her food? Have you heard of the Botswana Penal Code and what it says about people like you? Have you?
The daddy looked down at the ground and shook his head.
Well, said Mara Motswe, you go inside that house and get your things. Then I am going to take you to the bus station and you are going to get on a bus. Where do you really live?
Lobatse, said the daddy. But I don't like it down there.
Well, said Mara Motswe, maybe if you started doing something instead of just sitting in a chair, you might like it a bit more. There are lots of melons to grow down there. How about that for a start? Inside!
When Happy Bapetsi returned home, she found the daddy gone and his room cleared out. There was a note from Mara Motswe on the kitchen table, which she read, and as she did so, her smile returned.
That was not your daddy after all. I found out the best way. I got him to tell me himself. Maybe you will find the real daddy one day. Maybe not. But in the meantime, you can be happy again.
We don't forget, thought Mara Motswe. Our heads may be small, but they are as full of memories as the sky may sometimes be full of swarming bees. Thousands and thousands of memories, of smells, of places, of little things that happen to us and which come back unexpectedly to remind us who we are. And who am I? I am Precious Ramotswe, citizen of Botswana, daughter of Obed Ramotswe, who died because he had been a miner and could no longer breathe. His life was unrecorded. Who is there to write down the lives of ordinary people? I am Obed Ramotswe, and I was born in Mahalapye in 1930. Mahalapye is halfway between Habrone and Francistown, on that road that seems to go on and on forever. It was a dirt road in those days, of course, and the railway line was much more important. The track came down from Bulawayo, crossed into Botswana at Plumtree, and then headed south down the side of the country, all the way to Mafeking on the other side. As a boy, I used to watch the trains as they drew up at the siding. They let out great clouds of steam, and we would dare one another to run as close as we could to it. Mahalapye was a straggling village of huts made of brown, sun-baked mud bricks and a few tin roof buildings. These belonged to the government or the railways, and they seemed to us to represent distant, unattainable luxury. There was a school run by an old Anglican priest and a white woman whose face had been half destroyed by the sun. They both spoke Setswana, but they taught us in English, insisting on the pain of a thrashing that we left our own language outside in the playground. On the other side of the road was the beginning of the plain that stretched out into the Kalahari. It was featureless land, cluttered with low thorn trees, on the branches of which there perched the hornbills and the fluttering molopes with their long trailing tail feathers. It was a world that seemed to have no end, and that, I think, is what made Africa in those days so different. There was no end to it. A man could walk or ride forever, and he would never get anywhere. I am 60 now, and I do not think God wants me to live much longer. Dr. Moffat, at the Dutch Reformed Hospital in Mochudi, listened to my chest. He could tell that I had been a miner just by listening, and he shook his head and said that the mines have many different ways of hurting a man. As he spoke, I remembered a song which the Sotho miners used to sing. They sang, "The mines eat men. Even when you have left them, the mines may still be eating you." We all knew this was true. You could be killed by falling rock, or you could be killed years later, when going underground was just a bad dream that visited you at night. The mines would come back for their payment, just as they were coming back for me now. So I was not surprised by what Dr. Moffat said. I did not weep at that news which the doctor gave me. The only thing that makes me sad is that I shall be leaving Africa when I die. I love Africa, which is my mother and my father. When I am dead, I shall miss the smell of Africa, because they say that where you go, wherever that may be, there is no smell and no taste. I'm not saying that I'm a brave man. I'm not. But I can look back over my 60 years and think of everything that I have seen and of how I started with nothing and ended up with almost 200 cattle. And I have a good daughter, a loyal daughter, who looks after me well and makes me tea while I sit here in the sun and look out to the hills. When you see these hills from a distance, they are blue, as all the distances in this country are. We are far from the sea here, with Angola and Namibia between us and the coast. And yet we have this great empty ocean of blue above us and around us. No sailor could be lonelier than a man standing in the middle of our land, with the miles and miles of blue about him. I have never seen the sea, Although a man I worked with in the mines once invited me to his place down in Zululand. He told me that it had green hills that reached down to the Indian Ocean, and that he could look out of his doorway and see ships in the distance. He said that if I went with him, he might be able to get me a wife, and that they might overlook the fact that I was not a Zulu, if I was prepared to pay the father enough money for the girl. But why should I ever want anything but to live in Botswana and to marry a Tswana girl? I said to him that every man has a map in his heart of his own country, and that the heart will never allow you to forget this map. I told him that in Botswana, we did not have the green hills that he had in his place, nor the sea, but we had the Kalahari, and land that stretched further than one could imagine. I told him that if a man is born in a dry place, then although he may dream of rain, he does not want too much, and that he will not mind the sun that beats down and down. So I never went with him to Zululand, and I never saw the sea ever. But that has not made me unhappy, not once. So I sit here now, quite near the end, and think of everything that has happened to me. Not a day passes, though, that my mind does not go to God and to thoughts of what it will be like to die. I am not frightened of this, because I do not mind pain, and the pain that I feel is really quite bearable. They gave me pills, and they told me to take these if the pain in my chest became too great. But these pills make me sleepy, and I prefer to be awake. So I think of God and wonder what he will say to me when I stand before him. Some people think of God as a white man, which is an idea which the missionaries brought with them and which seems to have stuck in people's mind. I do not think this is so, because there is no difference between white men and black men. We are all the same. We are just people. And God was here anyway before the missionaries came. We called him by a different name then, and he did not live over at the Jews' place. He lived here in Africa, in the rocks, in the sky, in places where we knew he liked to be. When you died, you went somewhere else, and God would have been there too, but you would not be able to get specially close to him. Why should he want that? We have a story in Botswana about two children, a brother and sister, who are taken up to heaven by a whirlwind, and find that heaven is full of beautiful white cattle. That is how I like to think of it, and I hope that it is true. I hope that when I die, I find myself in a place where there are cattle like that, who have sweet breath and who are all about me. If that is what awaits me, then I am happy to go tomorrow, or even now, right at this moment. I should like to say goodbye to Precious, though, and to hold my daughter's hand as I went. That would be a happy way to go. I love our country, and I am proud to be a Motswana. There's no other country in Africa that can hold its head up as we can. We have no political prisoners, and never have had any. We have democracy. We have been careful. The Bank of Botswana is full of money from our diamonds. We owe nothing. But things were bad in the past. Before we built our country, we had to go off to South Africa to work. We went to the mines, just as people did from Lesotho and Mozambique and Malawi and all those countries. The mines sucked our men in and left the old men and the children at home. We dug for gold and diamonds and made those white men rich. I went to the mines when I was 18. We were the Botswana Land Protectorate then, and the British ran our country to protect us from the Boers. Oh, that is what they said. There was a commissioner down in Mafeking, over the border into South Africa, and he would come up the road and speak to the chiefs. He would say, "You do this thing, you do that thing." And the chiefs all obeyed him, because they knew that if they did not, he would have them deposed. But some of them were clever, and while the British said, "You do this,
they would say, "Yes, yes, sir, I will do that." And all the time, behind their back, they did the other thing, or they just pretended to do something. So for many years, nothing at all happened. It was a good system of government, because most people want nothing to happen. That is the problem with governments these days. They want to do things all the time. They are always very busy thinking of what things they can do next. That is not what people want. People want to be left alone to look after their cattle. We had left Malahapie by then and gone to live in Mochudi, where my mother's people lived. I liked Mochudi and would have been happy to stay there, but my father said I should go to the mines, as his lands were not good enough to support me and a wife. We did not have many cattle, and we grew just enough crops to keep us through the year. So when a recruiting truck came from over the border, I went to them, and they put me on a scale and listened to my chest and made me run up and down a ladder for 10 minutes. Then a man said that I would be a good miner, and they made me write my name on a piece of paper. They asked me the name of my chief and asked me whether I had ever been in any trouble with the police. That was all. I went off on the truck the next day. It took 12 hours to reach Johannesburg, as the roads were rough in those days. We travelled through the Western Transvaal, through the heat, cooped up in the truck like cattle. The older men told us that we would see things in Johannesburg which we could never have imagined existing, and that if we were weak or stupid, or if we did not work hard enough, our life from now on would be nothing but suffering. They told us that we would see cruelty and wickedness, but that if we stuck with other Botswana and did what we were told by the older men, we would survive. I thought that perhaps they were exaggerating, but these men spoke the absolute truth. What lay ahead of us was exactly what they had predicted, and even worse. In Johannesburg, they spent 2 weeks training us. We were all quite fit and strong, but nobody could be sent down the mines until he had been made even stronger. So they took us to a building which they had heated with steam, and they made us jump up and down onto benches for 4 hours each day. Somehow I survived it and passed on to the next part of our training. They talked to us about safety and how the rock could fall and crush us if we were careless. They carried in a man with no legs and put him down on a table and made us listen to him as he told us what had happened to him. They taught us Funagalo, which is the language used for giving orders underground. The Zulus laugh when they hear it, because there are so many Zulu words in it, but it is not Zulu. It is a language which is good for telling people what to do. There are many words for push, take, shove, carry, load, and no words for love or happiness, or the sounds which birds make in the morning. Then we went down to the shafts, and they put us in cages beneath great wheels, and these cages shot down as fast as hawks falling upon their prey. They had trains down there, small trains, and they put us on these and took us to the end of long, dark tunnels, which were filled with green rock and dust. My job was to load rock after it had been blasted, and I did this for 7 hours a day. I grew strong. But all the time there was dust, dust, dust. Some of the mines were more dangerous than others, and we all knew which these were. We all knew that the only way to survive was to get into a crew where the men had what everybody called rock sense. Every good miner had to be able to see what the rock was doing, what it was feeling, and to know when new supports were needed. If one or two men in a crew did not know this, then it did not matter how good the others were. The rock would come down, and it fell on good miners and bad. There was another thing which affected your chances of survival, and this was the sort of white miner you had. The white miners were put in charge of the teams, and if a team was good, then the boss boy knew exactly what to do and how to do it. The white miner would pretend to give the orders, but he knew that it would be the boss boy who really got the work done. But a stupid white miner would drive his team too hard. He would shout and hit the men if he thought they were not working quickly enough, and this could be very dangerous. Yet when the rock came down, the white miner would be back down the tunnel with the other white miners, waiting for us to report that the work had been finished. It was not unusual for a white miner to beat his men if he got into a temper.
They were not meant to, but the shift bosses always turned a blind eye. Yet we were never allowed to hit back. If you hit a white miner, you were finished. The mine police would be waiting for you at the top of the shaft, and you could spend a year or two in prison. The Swazis were all in one gang, and the Zulus in another, and the Malawians in another, and so on. Everybody was with his people and had to obey the boss boy. If you didn't, and the boss boy said that a man was making trouble, they would send him home or arrange for the police to beat him until he started to be reasonable again. We were all afraid of the Zulus. Although, I had that friend who was a kind Zulu. The Zulus thought they were better than any of us. And if there was a fight, it was almost always the Zulus or the Basutu, but never the Botswana. We did not like fighting. I worked for years in those mines, and I saved all my money. Other men spent it on town women and drink and on fancy clothes. I bought nothing, not even a gramophone. I sent the money home to the Standard Bank, and then I bought cattle with it. Each year I bought a few cows and gave them to my cousin to look after. They had calves, and slowly my head got bigger. I would have stayed on in the mines, I suppose, had I not witnessed a terrible thing. It happened after I had been there for 15 years. I had then been given a much better job, carrying explosives for a blaster and helping him with the fuses. This was a good job, and I liked the man I worked for. He had left something in a tunnel once, and he had asked me to fetch it. So I went off and looked for this can. The tunnel was lit by bulbs, so it was quite safe to walk along it. But you still had to be careful, because here and there were great galleries which had been blasted out of the rock. These could be 200 feet deep, and they opened out from the sides of the tunnel to drop down to another working level, like underground quarries. Men fell into these galleries from time to time, and it was always their fault. They were not looking where they were walking, or were walking along an unlit tunnel when the batteries in their helmet lights were weak. Sometimes a man just walked over the edge for no reason at all, or because he was unhappy and did not want to live anymore. I turned a corner in this tunnel and found myself in a round chamber. There was a gallery at the end of this, and four men were standing at the edge of this, and they were holding another man by his arms and legs. As I came round the corner, they lifted him and threw him over the edge and into the dark. The man screamed, and then he was gone. The men had not seen me yet, but one turned round and shouted out in Zulu. Then they began to run towards me. I turned round and ran back along the tunnel. I knew that if they caught me, I would follow their victim into the gallery. It was not a race I could let myself lose. Although I got away, I knew that those men had seen me and that I would be killed, and so I knew that I could not stay in the mines. The blaster listened to me carefully when I told him that I would have to go. He understood, but still he tried to persuade me to go to the police. "Tell them what you saw," he said in Afrikaans. "Tell them. They can catch the Zulus and hang them." "I don't know who these men are. They'll catch me first. I'm going home to my place." He looked at me and nodded. Then he took my hand and shook it, which is the first time a white man had done that to me. So I called him my brother, which is the first time I had done that to a white man. "You go back home to your wife," he said. "Go back and give her more children." So I left the mine secretly, like a thief, and came back to Botswana in 1960. I cannot tell you how full my heart was when I crossed the border back into Botswana and left South Africa behind me forever. In that place, I had felt every day that I might die. Danger and sorrow hung over Johannesburg like a cloud, and I could never be happy there. In Botswana, it was different. There were no policemen with dogs. There were no Tutsis with knives waiting to rob you. You did not wake up every morning to a wailing siren calling you down into the hot earth. There were not the same great crowds of men, all from some distant place, all sickening for home, all wanting to be somewhere else. I had left a prison, a great groaning prison under the sunlight.
When I came home that time and got off the bus at Mochudi and saw the copier and the chief's place and the goats, I just stood and cried. I had taken a wife 3 years earlier, although we had seen very little of one another since the marriage. I came back from Johannesburg once a year for 1 month, and this was all the life we had had together. After my last trip, she had become pregnant, and my little girl had been born while I was still away. Now I was to see her, and my wife had brought her to meet me off the bus. She stood there with the child in her arms, the child who was more valuable to me than all the gold taken out of those mines in Johannesburg. This was my firstborn and my only child, my girl, my precious Ramotswe. Precious was like a mother, who was a good, fat woman. She played in the yard outside the house and laughed when I picked her up. I had a cow that gave good milk, and I kept this nearby for Precious. We gave her plenty of syrup, too, and eggs every day. My wife put Vaseline on her skin and polished it so that she shone. Then my wife, the mother of Precious, died. She used to go from our place to visit an aunt of hers who lived over the railway line near the Francistown Road. She carried food there, as that aunt was too old to look after herself. I don't know how it happened, but she was on the railway line when the train from Bulawayo came down and hit her. The engine driver was very sorry, but he had not seen her at all. My cousin came to look after Precious. She made her clothes, took her to school, and cooked our meals. I was a sad man, and I thought, now there's nothing left for you in this life but Precious and your cattle. I had more cattle now, and I had even thought of buying a store, but the dust from the mines had ruined my chest, and I could not walk fast or lift things. One day I was on my way back from the cattle post, and I was sitting under a tree by the roadside waiting for the bus. I fell asleep and was woken by the sound of a car drawing up. It was a large car, and there was a man sitting in the back. The driver spoke to me in Setswana, although the number plate of the car was from South Africa. The driver said that there was a leak in the radiator, and did I know where they might find some water? As it happened, there was a cattle watering tank along the track to my cattle post, and so I went with the driver, and we filled a can with water. When we came back, the man in the back had got out, and he smiled to show that he was grateful for my help, and I smiled back. Then I realized this was the man who managed all those mines in Johannesburg, one of Mr. Oppenheimer's men. I told him who I was. I told him that I was sorry that I had had to leave early, but that it had been because of circumstances beyond my control. He laughed and said that it was good of me to have worked in the mines for so many years. He said that he would take me to Mochudi. So I arrived back in Mochudi in that car, and this important man came into my house. He saw Precious and told me that she was a very fine child. Then, after he had drunk some tea, he looked at his watch. "I must go back now," he said. "I have to get back to Johannesburg." I said that his wife would be angry if he was not back in time for the food she had cooked him. He said this would probably be so. We walked outside. Mr. Oppenheimer's man said I had been one of Mr. Oppenheimer's people, and Mr. Oppenheimer liked to look after his people. He then gave me 200 rands, and I said that I would use it to buy a bull, since I had just lost one. He was pleased with this. I told him to go in peace, and he said that I should stay in peace. So we left one another, and I never saw my friend again, although he is always there in my heart.
Obed Ramotswe installed his cousin in a room at the back of the small house he had built for himself at the edge of the village, when he had returned from the mines. With a bed and a small cupboard, and with a coat of whitewash applied to the walls, from the point of view of the cousin, the room was luxury almost beyond imagination. After the departure of her husband 6 years previously, she had returned to live with her mother and her grandmother, and had been required to sleep in a room which had only 3 walls, one of which did not quite reach the roof. They had treated her with quiet contempt, being old-fashioned people, who believed that a woman who was left by her husband would almost always have deserved her fate. It was duty rather than affection which opened their door to her. Her husband had left her because she was barren, a fate which was almost inevitable for the childless woman. She had spent what little money she had on consultations with traditional healers, one of whom had promised her that she would conceive within months of his attentions. He had administered a variety of herbs and powdered barks, and when these did not work, he had turned to charms. Several of the potions had made her ill, and one had almost killed her, but the barrenness remained, and shortly after he left, her husband wrote to her from Lobatse, and told her, proudly, that his new wife was pregnant. Then, 1.5 years later, there came a short letter with a photograph of his child. No money was sent, and that was the last time she heard from him. Now, holding Precious in her arms, standing in her own room with its 4 stout, whitewashed walls, her happiness was complete. She allowed Precious, now 4, to sleep with her in her bed, lying awake at night for long hours to listen to the child's breathing. She stroked her skin, held the tiny hand between her fingers, and marvelled at the completeness of the child's body. When Precious slept during the afternoon in the heat, she would sit beside her, knitting and sewing tiny jackets and socks in bright reds and blues, and brush flies away from the sleeping child. Obed, too, was content. He gave his cousin money each week to buy food for the household and a little extra each month for herself. She husbanded resources well, and there was always money left over, which she spent on something for Precious. Everything was perfect. The cousin wanted Precious to be clever. She had had little education herself, but she sensed the possibilities for change. There was a political party now, which women could join, although some men said it was asking for trouble. Nobody challenged men openly, but when women spoke now amongst themselves, there were whispers and looks exchanged. She thought of her own life, of the early marriage to a man she had barely met, and of the shame of her inability to bear children. She remembered the years of living in the room with 3 walls, and the tasks which had been imposed upon her, unpaid. One day, women would be able to sound their own voice, perhaps, and would point out what was wrong. But they would need to be able to read to do that. She started by teaching Precious to count. They counted goats and cattle. They counted trees, giving each tree a name. Crooked one, one with no leaves, one where Mapani worms like to hide, one where no bird will go. Then she said, "If we chop down the tree which looks like an old man, then how many trees are there left?" She made Precious remember lists of things, the names of members of the family, the names of the chiefs. Sometimes they sat outside the store nearby, the small upright general dealer, and waited for a car or a truck to bump its way past on the pothole-pitted road. The cousin would call out the number on the registration plate, and Precious would have to remember it the next day when she was asked. They also played a variety of Kim's game, in which the cousin would load a basketwork tray with familiar objects, and a blanket would then be draped over it, and one object removed.
"What has been taken from the tray?"
"An old marula pip, all gnarled and chewed up."
She was never wrong, this child who watched everybody and everything with her wide, solemn eyes. And slowly, without anybody ever having intended this, the qualities of curiosity and awareness were nurtured in the child's mind. By the time Precious went to school at the age of 6, she knew her alphabet, her numbers up to 200, and she could recite the entire first chapter of the Book of Genesis in the Setswana translation. She had also learnt a few words of English, and could declaim all 4 verses of an English poem about ships and the sea. The teacher complimented the cousin on what she had done. This was virtually the first praise that she had ever received for any task she had performed. Obed had thanked her generously, but it had not occurred to him to praise her, because in his view she was just doing her duty as a woman, and there was nothing special about that. "We are the ones who first ploughed the earth when Modise, God, made it," ran an old Setswana poem. "We were the ones who made the food. We are the ones who look after the men when they are little boys, when they are young men, and when they are old and about to die. We are always there. But we are just women, and nobody sees us." Ma Ramotswe thought, "God put us on this earth. We were all Africans then, in the beginning, because man started in Kenya, as Dr. Leakey and his daddy have proved. So if one thinks carefully about it, we are all brothers and sisters, and yet everywhere you look, what do you see? Fighting, fighting, fighting. Rich people killing poor people killing rich people, everywhere, except Botswana. That's thanks to Sir Seretse Khama, who was a good man, who invented Botswana and made it a good place. The problem, of course, was that people did not seem to understand the difference between right and wrong. Precious Ramotswe had learned about good and evil at Sunday school. The cousin had taken her there when she was 6, and she had gone there every Sunday without fail until she was 11. That was enough time for her to learn all about right and wrong, although she had been puzzled, and remained so, when it came to certain other aspects of religion. She could not believe that the Lord had walked on water. You just couldn't do that. Nor had she believed the story about the feeding of the 5,000, which was equally impossible. These were lies, she was sure of it. And the biggest lie of all was that the Lord had no daddy on earth. Even children knew that you needed a father to make a child, and that rule applied to cattle and chickens and people all the same. But right and wrong, that was another matter, and she had experienced no difficulty in understanding that it was wrong to lie and steal and kill other people. If people needed clear guidelines, there was nobody better to do this than Ma Motibi, who had run the Sunday school at Machudi for over 12 years. She was a short lady, almost entirely round, who spoke with an exceptionally deep voice. She taught the children hymns in both Setswana and English, and because they learned their singing from her, the children's choir all sang an octave below everybody else, as if they were frogs. The children, dressed in their best clothes, sat in rows at the back of the church when the service had finished, and Ma Motibi read the Bible to them and made them recite the Ten Commandments over and over again, and told them religious stories from a small blue book which she said came from London. "These are the rules for being good," she intoned. "A boy must always rise early and say his prayers. Then he must clean his shoes and help his mother to prepare the family's breakfast, if they have breakfast. Some people have no breakfast because they are poor. Then he must go to school and do everything that his teacher tells him. In that way, he will learn to be a clever Christian boy who will go to heaven later on, when the Lord calls him home. For girls, the rules are the same, but they must also be careful about boys and must be ready to tell boys that they are Christians. Some boys will not understand this." Yes, thought precious Ramotswe, some boys do not understand this. And even there, in that Sunday school, there was such a boy, that Josiah, who was a wicked boy, although he was only 9. He insisted on sitting next to Precious, even when she tried to avoid him. He was always looking at her and smiling encouragingly. He tried also to make sure that his leg touched hers, which angered her and made her shift in her seat away from him. But worst of all, he would undo the buttons of his trousers and point to that thing that boys have and expect her to look. She did not like this, as it was not something that should happen in a Sunday school. At last she told Ma Motibi about it, and the teacher listened gravely. "Boys, men," she said. "They all think that this is something special and they're so proud of it. They do not know how ridiculous it is." She told Precious to tell her next time it happened. She just had to raise her hand a little and Ma Motibi would see her. It happened the next week. While Marmotibi was at the back of the class, Josiah undid a button and whispered to Precious that she should look down. She kept her eyes on her book and raised her left hand slightly. He could not see this, but Marmotibi did. She crept up behind the boy and brought her Bible down on his head with a thud that made the children start. Josiah buckled under the blow. Marmotibi now came round to his front and pointed at his open fly. Then she raised the Bible and struck him on the top of the head again, even harder than before. That was the last time that Josiah bothered Precious Ramotswe, or any other girl. For her part, Precious learned an important lesson about how to deal with men, and this lesson was to prove very useful later on, as were all the lessons of Sunday school. The cousin looked after Precious for the first 8 years of her life. She might have stayed indefinitely, which would have suited Obed, as the cousin kept house for him and never complained or asked him for money. But he readily gave his blessing when the cousin announced that she had been seeing a man, that he had proposed, and that she had accepted.
"I could take Precious with me," she said. "I feel that she is my daughter now. But there is you."
"Yes," said Obed, "there is me. Would you take me too?" The cousin laughed.
"My new husband is a rich man, but I think that he wants to marry only one person."
Obed made arrangements for the wedding, and he did it readily because of all she had done for him. He arranged for the slaughter of 2 cattle and for the brewing of enough beer for 200 people. Then, with the cousin on his arm, he entered the church and saw the new husband and his people, and other distant cousins and their friends, and people from the village, invited and uninvited, waiting and watching. After the wedding ceremony, they went back to the house, where the old people sat down while the young moved about and talked to one another, and sniffed the air at the great quantities of meat that were sizzling on the open fires. The new husband owned 2 buses, which made him wealthy. One of these, the Mole Polole Special Express, was decked for the occasion with bright blue cloth. In the other, they drove off after the party, with the husband at the wheel and the new bride sitting in the seat immediately behind him. There were cries of excitement and ululation from the women, and the bus drove off into happiness. They set up home 10 miles south of Haberone, in an adobe-plastered house which had a red roof and white walls, and a compound, in the traditional style, with a walled yard to the front. At the back, there was a small shack for a servant to live in, and a lean-to latrine made out of galvanized tin. The cousin had a kitchen with a shining new set of pans and 2 cookers. She had a large new South African paraffin-powered fridge, which purred quietly all day and kept everything icy cold within. Every evening her husband came home with the day's takings, and she helped him to count the money. She proved to be an excellent bookkeeper, and was soon running that part of the business with conspicuous success. She made her new husband happy in other ways. As a boy, he had been bitten by a jackal and had scars across his face. No woman had told him that he was handsome before, and he had never dreamed that any would. The cousin, though, said that he was the most good-looking man she had ever met, and the most virile, too. This was not mere flattery. She was telling the truth as she saw it, and his heart was filled with the warmth that flows from the well-directed compliment.
"I know you are missing me," the cousin wrote to Precious, "but I know that you want me to be happy. I am very happy now. I have a very kind husband who makes me very happy every day. One day you will come and stay with us, and we can count the trees again and sing hymns together as we always used to. Now you must look after your father, who is a good man too. I want you to be happy, and that is what I pray for every night. God look after Precious Ramotswe. God watch her tonight and forever. Amen."
As a girl, Precious Ramotswe liked to draw. She had been given a sketching pad and a set of coloured pencils for her 10th birthday, and her talent had soon become apparent. Obed Ramotswe was proud of her ability to fill her sketchbook with scenes of everyday Mochudi life. Here was a sketch which showed the pond in front of the hospital. It was all quite recognisable. And here was a picture of the hospital matron looking at a donkey. And on this page was a picture of the shop, of the small, upright general dealer, with things in front of it which could be sacks of mealies or perhaps people sitting down. One could not tell. But they were excellent sketches, and he had already pinned several up on the walls of the living room of their house. The school got to hear of an art competition for children. The museum in Habrone had asked every school in the country to submit a picture by one of its pupils on the theme Life in Botswana of Today. Precious was asked to draw a special picture, and then this would be sent down to Habrone as the entry from Mochudi. She drew her picture on a Saturday, and it was a very good drawing, she thought, and her teacher was enthusiastic when she showed it to her the following Monday.
"This will win the prize for Mochudi," she said. "Everybody will be proud."
The drawing was sent off, registered post, to the museum. Then there was a silence for 5 weeks, during which time everybody forgot about the competition. Only when the letter came to the principal, and he, beaming, read it out to Precious, were they reminded.
"You have won first prize," he said. "You are to go to Habrone with your teacher and myself and your father to get the prize from the Minister of Education at a special ceremony."
They travelled down with the principal in his truck, arriving far too early for the ceremony, and spent several hours sitting in the museum yard, waiting for the doors to open. But at last they did, and others came, teachers, people from the newspapers, members of the legislature. Then the minister arrived, and people put down their glasses of orange juice and swallowed the last of their sandwiches. She saw her painting, hanging in a special place, on a room divider, and there was a small card pinned underneath it. She saw with leaping heart her name neatly typed out underneath the picture. Precious Ramotswe, 10, Mochudi Government Junior School. And underneath that, also typed, the title which the museum itself had provided. Cattle Beside Dam. She stood rigid, appalled. This was not true. The picture was of goats, but they had thought it was cattle. She was getting a prize for a cattle picture by false pretences. "What is wrong?" asked her father. "Why are you looking so sad?" She could not say anything. She was about to become a criminal, a perpetrator of fraud. She could not possibly take a prize for a cattle picture when she simply did not deserve that. But now the minister was standing beside her, and she looked up at him, and he smiled warmly.
"You are a very good artist," he said. "Mochudi must be proud of you."
"It is not a picture of cattle," she said. "It is a picture of goats. You cannot give me a prize for a mistake."
The minister frowned and looked at the label. Then he turned back to her and said,
"They are the ones who have made a mistake. I also think those are goats. I do not think they are cattle."
The director of the museum asked for silence.
"This excellent picture of goats," said the minister, "shows how talented are our young people in this country. This young lady will grow up to be a fine citizen and maybe a famous artist. She deserves her prize, and I am now giving it to her."
She took the wrapped parcel which he gave her and felt his hand upon her shoulder and heard him whisper,
"You are the most truthful child I have met. Well done."
Then the ceremony was over, and they returned to Mochudi in the principal's bumpy truck, a heroine returning, a bearer of prizes. At the age of 16, Ma Ramotswe left school. Her father had wanted her to stay on, but Ma Ramotswe was bored with Machudi. She wanted to go somewhere. She wanted her life to start.
You can go to my cousin, her father said. I think that you will find lots of things happening in that house.
It cost him a great deal of pain to say this. He wanted her to stay, to look after him, but he knew that it would be selfish to expect her life to revolve around his. And at the back of his mind was the thought of marriage. In a very short time, there would be men wanting to marry her. He would never deny her that, of course, but what if the man who wanted to marry her was a bully, or a drunkard, or a womanizer? All of this was possible. There was any number of men like that, waiting for an attractive girl whose life they could slowly destroy. These men were like leeches. They sucked away at the goodness of a woman's heart until it was dry and all her love had been used up. That took a long time, he knew, because women seemed to have vast reservoirs of goodness in them. If one of these men claimed precious, then what could he, a father, do? He could warn her of the risk. But whoever listened to warnings about somebody they loved? He had seen it so often before. Love was a form of blindness that closed the eyes to the most glaring faults. You could love a murderer, and simply not believe that your lover would do so much as crush a tick, let alone kill somebody. There would be no point trying to dissuade her. At least the cousin could keep an eye on her niece, and her husband might be able to chase the most unsuitable men away. He was a rich man now, with more than 5 buses, and he would have that authority that rich men had. The cousin was pleased to have Precious in the house. She decorated a room for her, hanging new curtains of a thick yellow material, which she had bought from the OK bazaars on a shopping trip to Johannesburg. Then she filled a chest of drawers with clothes and put on top of it a framed picture of the Pope. The floor was covered with a simply patterned reed mat. It was a bright, comfortable room. Precious was given a job in the office of the bus company, and the cousin's husband noticed that she was doing as much work as the 2 older clerks put together. It was easy for Precious, with her memory, to remember how to do new things and to apply the knowledge faultlessly. She was also willing to make suggestions, and scarcely a week went past in which she failed to make some suggestion as to how the office could be more efficient.
"You're working too hard," said one of the clerks to her. "You're trying to take our jobs."
Precious looked at them blankly. She had always worked as hard as she could, at everything she did, and she simply did not understand how anybody could do otherwise. How could they sit there, as they did, and stare into the space in front of their desks, when they could be adding up figures or checking the driver's returns? Now and then she found a small discrepancy. These came from the giving of incorrect change, the cousin explained. It was easy enough to do on a crowded bus, and as long as it was not too significant, they just ignored it. But Precious found a discrepancy of slightly over 2,000 puller in the fuel bills invoices, and she drew this to the attention of her cousin's husband.
"Are you sure?" he asked. "How could 2,000 puller go missing?"
"Stolen," said Precious. The cousin's husband shook his head. He regarded himself as a model employer. A paternalist, yes, but that is what the men wanted, was it not? He could not believe that any of his employees would cheat him. How could they, when he was so good to them and did so much for them? Precious showed him how the money had been taken, and they jointly pieced together how it had been moved out of the right account into another one, and had then eventually vanished altogether. Only one of the clerks had access to these funds, so it must have been him. She did not see the confrontation, but heard it from the other room. The clerk was indignant, shouting his denial at the top of his voice. Then there was silence for a moment, and the slamming of a door. This was her first case. This was the beginning of the career of Ma Ramotswe. There were 4 years of working in the bus office. The cousin and her husband began to call her their daughter. She did not mind this. They were her people, and she loved them. Every weekend, she travelled up to Machudi on one of the cousin's husband's buses and visited her father. He would be waiting outside the house, sitting on his stool, and she would curtsy before him in the old way and clap her hands. Then they would eat together. sitting in the shade of the lean-to veranda which he had erected to the side of the house. She would tell him about the week's activity in the bus office, and he would take in every detail, asking for names, which he would link into elaborate genealogies. Everybody was related in some way. There was nobody who could not be fitted into the far-flung corners of family. It was the same with cattle. Cattle had their families, and after she had finished speaking, he would tell her the cattle news. Although he rarely went out to the cattle post, he had reports every week, and he could run the lives of the cattle through the herd boys. He had an eye for cattle. He could tell at a glance whether a calf which seemed puny, and which was therefore cheap, could be brought on and fattened. And he bought such animals and made them into fine, butterfat cattle, if the rains were good. He said that people were like their cattle. Thin, wretched cattle had thin, wretched owners. Listless cattle had owners whose lives lacked focus. And dishonest people had dishonest cattle. Cattle which would cheat other cattle of food, or which would try to insinuate themselves into the herds of others. Obed Ramotswe was a severe judge of men and cattle, and she found herself thinking, what will he say when he finds out about Not Makoti? She had met Not Makoti on a bus on the way back from Machudi. He was sitting in the front, his trumpet case on the seat beside him. She could not help but notice him in his red shirt and seersucker trousers, nor fail to see the high cheekbones and the arched eyebrows. It was a proud face, the face of a man used to being looked at and appreciated, and she dropped her eyes immediately. She would not want him to think she was looking at him. Who was this man? A musician, with that case beside him. A clever person from the university, perhaps. The bus stopped in Habrone before going south on the road to Lobatse. She saw him get up. He stood up, straightened the crease of his trousers, and then turned and looked down the bus. She felt her heart jump. He had looked at her. No, he was looking out of the window. Suddenly, without thinking, she got to her feet and took her bag down from the rack. She would get off, not because she had anything to do in Habrone, but because she wanted to see what he did. He had left the bus now, and she hurried, muttering a quick explanation to the driver, one of her cousin's husband's men. Out in the crowd, in the late afternoon sunlight, redolent of dust and hot travellers, she looked about and saw him standing not far away. She felt that unsettling sensation again, and she stopped where she stood, as if she were a stranger who was uncertain where to go.